It's time again for the Scotty Johnny Podcast with your host, Scotty Johnny himself, John Barnett, and the ego himself, Cheddar Talk, Aaron Flottam. Talking Wisconsin sports, two mics, two crusty vets, two opinions, one based in reality and one based in what he read on Twitter. With music by Duluth Greats, Cars and Trucks, here's John and Aaron.
Welcome, welcome, one and all. Welcome into the Scotty Johnny Podcast. I am your not-so-humble host, Jonathan Barnett, with you again. This week again, Aaron is at annual training with the National Guard. Aaron will not be joining me this week, but we hope he's having fun doing, you know, soldier things, whether he's sleeping on the ground or not. I guess I'm not sure at this point, but wishing him well. Hope he enjoys it, and we'll have him back very soon. I guarantee it, but just not this week. So we'll be going John solo. The things I want to let you know is, of course, that you can follow the show at ScottyJohnny1 on Twitter. You can also follow me at jbarn54, J-B-A-R-N-5-4. You can also follow Aaron at Cheddar Talk. All right? So the other things to point out, I guess, is that we do have a website. It's ScottyJohnny.com, and we do have a Facebook page, so search out Scotty Johnny, and you should be able to find information there. We try to make sure our stuff gets out to any number of different places, but thank you for listening. Remind your friends to follow the show, to listen to the show. We'll try to be out there and available. So if you can also give us some reviews, favorable reviews, we hope, for those 5-star reviews if you can. And that helps other people to find the show. The more 5-star reviews something has, the easier it is to find, the more it shows up in search engines and things like that. So when we start looking for people looking for Packers talk, for eventually, sooner or later, there will be some Badgers football talk coming up here. And also then, continuing Brewers talk as we get through things. And speaking of all that, we'll get things started off right away with our main event.
Starting things off with the main event.
So we will be starting with Brewers this week. I think the Packers stuff can wait till the end here because it's not really camp-specific related. I think the big things here is this was not the week. This has not been the month we've been hoping from the Brewers. This was a month where they really had a chance to make up some ground here. They failed to do so last week, like we talked with Miami, and that's definitely something that's very concerning at this point for what this team has been and what this team should be at this point. The other thing going on here is that we had a tough time this week. The Brewers got me very hopeful. They get my hopes up. This is what the Brewers do, is they get my hopes up only to crush my hopes and make me feel sad. They exist to keep us humble in Wisconsin. So we started off, we had Houston, and we were not looking forward to playing Houston in Houston. We're going to end up getting Verlander in one of these two starts. The only real value to this is that we did have day off before going to Houston, day off after being in Houston, and then we were supposed to get this trip where we're going to go play the Giants, who are not good, and then play the Padres, who are not good, followed up, you know, back-to-back. So 2-3-game sets there. But a 2-game series in Houston, the best parts about it were day off before, day off after, make sure we can use whatever pitchers we need. Additionally, it was going to be nice. It was only 2 games. That was not going to be a killer 3-game series or a 4-game or anything like that. It was a 2-game set. And I apologize. I know when I get worked up, I go a little faster. And that's just kind of how I talk, and it's something I keep track of when I'm in court because they're writing down my words. Hopefully you're all keeping up with me, and I try to keep it a little slower if I can. And sometimes I have to speak faster because, you know, also normally Aaron's interrupting me now, trying to get in things, and if I don't speak fast, coming from a family of 3 boys who talk, if I don't speak fast, it's not getting said, and it's not getting in, and everyone will move on without me. Okay, so anyhow, Brewer game, Tuesday, June 11th. That's when we start this all off. They get a, it is, this game gets away from the Brewers right around the time that the starting pitching starts to fail off. So, I mean, it's doing okay. In the bottom of the fifth, the Brewers are down 4-3. All right, so it they're in it into the fifth. Bottom of the fifth, just right away then, Michael Brantley gets an RBI triple. Yuli Gurriel comes with an RBI single to drive in Brantley. Then Yordan Alvarez gets a 2-run home run with Gurriel on base. So suddenly it's then 8-3. 4 runs come in very, very quickly with a triple, a single, and a home run. That game's over at that point. Getting to the fifth inning, Peralta got us to the fifth inning. He only threw 84 pitches because in the fifth inning, and statistically wise, he only threw four innings because he didn't get out of the fifth. He didn't get a single out in the fifth, to be more clear, I guess. He gets things started, gets up the triple, gives up the single, and he's out with six earned runs. So he's out at that point. It is, 6-3. They end up getting down 8-3, and it's just something where they just they never recover from something like that. Being down 8-3, this team can hit, but asking them to score eight runs, six runs repeatedly, is just something that's very difficult to try to maintain. So they're down 8-3. They eventually end up being down 10-4, and they get a couple of runs late. They get home runs in the eighth and ninth. Shaw gets his fifth in the eighth, and then Grandal comes in. He's been hitting lights out. Just massive power from Grandal this week. Several home runs. I think he had four total this week. Anyhow, yeah, the big thing is Peralta. Peralta, who is the biggest up-and-down guy, if he's going to be on, he's untouchable. I mean, he's throwing the fastball. It's cutting. It's coming in, going out. It's moving, and things are doing really, really well for him. But when he doesn't, the minute it doesn't, he's getting lit up, and it's really hard to try to just deal with these sort of inconsistencies we're getting from the starting pitching at this point. And again, in the fifth inning, it's 4-3. The Brewers are in a game with one of the best teams in baseball on the road, and they just give up those points where they're giving up, and I don't mean points instead of runs, I mean those points, those individual little sections of things where they're giving up a guy who's not tired. I mean, everybody's got their days off. Peralta only goes 84 pitches into this game. And it's already 8-3 before almost anything can go the Brewers' way, before they can really get any momentum back the other way. And that game is just done. It looks closer than it is because it ends up being 10-8, and you think, well, they were kind of in this. No, the late runs really just put them back in it in the eighth and ninth inning. Brewers were chasing from the fifth inning on, just trying to struggle. And it's hard to be trying to score runs and trying to stay there when you've got a pitcher in a game like that with a team like Houston that knows they're playing with a lead. It's harder to step into that batter's box and try to just constantly be playing from behind, knowing that each one of your at-bats is just walking you closer to a possible late-inning need for these runs. You need to have that sort of, that urgency that they have to have, and it becomes far more of a need for urgency when you're down in the fifth, right like that, right in that middle of the game when things fall apart. Now Wednesday got far more interesting because it cannot be a week with the Milwaukee Brewers without there being some sort of extra inning game. We've just had this so many times this year, and I don't know if there's a, I guess I don't know if there's a metric that tells you why it is teams end up going into these late inning games or what it is that leads to these. Now, I know in hockey, one of the things that they try to tell you is when you have teams that win games, you have to look at the types of winnings, because teams that win in shootouts, those wins almost don't count because it's kind of a flip of the hat there. When you start going that late into games, playing in the extra time, getting the win, which, in hockey gets you the 2 points versus the 1 point loss in overtime and 0 points for a regular loss. But in baseball, I don't know if the metric track this, and it'd be interesting to see if they do, the number of times the Brewers have gone into extra innings. And I think that when they get into those extra innings, they've been fairly successful because it kind of means you're playing a team who is also not hitting. And, they went 14 innings on Wednesday. And the hard part is there were seven innings pitched by Verlander, and he pitched very, very well. I mean, he got 15 strikeouts in seven innings. The problem is he gave up three solo home runs. He didn't give up a lot of hits, but three of them left the park. Thames, Braun, and Grandal all get those home runs and keep the Brewers in it. Verlander doesn't even figure, well, he wouldn't have figured in the decision even if it had been a nine-inning game, because he leaves as a 3-3 game after seven. So then it goes all the way to the 14th. So seven innings from Verlander and seven innings from other pitchers. And the other pitchers also give up three runs. Moustakas comes up in the 14th, gets a two-run home run, drives in Yelich, as well as himself, of course. And then back from the dead, Jesus Aguilar singles in Grandal later in that same inning, obviously, since it's extra innings. And they get the 6-3 win. So getting a split got my hopes up. This is exactly where we were. The Brewers got my hopes up. Got me thinking like, hey, things are turning around. This is going to be the June we wanted. This is going to be the June we were talking about. But they get Thursday off to come back on Flag Day. Flag Day, first celebrated in Wisconsin. I think there were some other people talked about it, but it was first organized celebration was in, I believe it's Wabika, Wisconsin. Also, June 14th is the Army birthday, 244th birthday for the United States Army. And Aaron's in the field for that. So on that day, though, the Brewers played in San Francisco against a not good Giants team. Now, this is one where it is 2-2 in the, I believe, the fifth yet, right? Yeah. When Kevin Pillar gets a home run off Davies. This Davies takes up his first loss. He's now 7-1. I think he's had another rough game, but it didn't end up being a loss for him on that one. He didn't take the L for the team. So he drops to 7-1. He gives up a home run, solo home run to make it 3-2. And then a couple innings later against one of the other pitchers, because Davies only goes to 5, I believe, gives up 3 runs over 5. Mike Yastrzemski, I believe, from that Yastrzemski family somewhere, added another 2-run home run later on in the 7th inning. Now, they made it look a little bit better towards the end here because Jesus Aguilar, this is one of my favorite parts of the game, he scores on a wild pitch with the bases loaded. Melanson is pitching, bases loaded, gets a wild pitch, gets away, and Jesus Aguilar scores on a wild pitch. Now, I just love the image of that because he is a big man barreling through from third base. He's not a fast man, but I just love that he was able to book it through. I mean, he's still fighting. He's had a hard time at the plate. He's back up to 200 now in the batting average, but that's not great. That's just something where you're glad it's not worse because it's been worse most of the year. He's been batting around 170. Battling his way back to being a 200 hitter here has been a bit of a struggle. Now, he scores on the wild pitch. Also brings me to one of my other favorite points about this game. The first run of the game in the first inning, Orlando Arcia scores on a passed ball. Stephen Vogt playing in this game, I believe, here too. No, I'm sorry. This one was one with Posey. Vogt was playing in the other games. Passed ball gets by Posey, and Arcia scores in the first inning on a passed ball. The Brewers lost 5-3. They scored on a passed ball and a wild pitch, and only one run was somebody batted in. Their first and their last runs scored in the first and the eighth. We're both on balls that a catcher didn't catch, where somebody scored from third, where no hit. The ball never went in play. It's a frustrating sort of thing. But at this point, then, you've got a really rough road loss at San Francisco. The Saturday loss was far harder to deal with. I mean, they're up 5-1 in the fifth. It's the fifth inning again. Giving a fifth inning home run by Davies against the Giants on Friday. They get the fifth inning from Peralta that just killed them on Tuesday. And then on Saturday in the fifth inning, Nelson's doing okay. They're up 5-1 in the fifth. And then just Nelson implodes at that point. He has a 4-pitch walk to Madison Bumgarner. And I mean, for a pitcher, he can hit. But you throw it. I mean, the idea that he threw 4 straight balls to Bumgarner, like he's afraid of him, is just terrifying. Like, I don't understand that. Throws a 5-pitch walk to Joe Panik and then a 4-pitch walk to Yastrzemski. The line says that he pitched 4 innings, Nelson, and gave up 4 runs. But he came into the fifth, faced 3 batters with a 5-1 lead, left the game with a 5-1 lead. Problem is he walked 3 batters and left them on base when he left the game. All 3 of those guys are coming home to score because they bring in Hauser. Hauser walks Belt on 5 pitches, so brings in Bumgarner. Bumgarner has gotten all the way around the base without anybody hitting the ball in play. 4 straight walks brings in the run to make it 5-2. Now, Hauser is facing kind of a rough spot there, so he's got to go after Brandon Belt with the bases loaded, coming in cold. That's a hard spot to be in, but still, a 5-pitch walk. You got to make them beat you. You got to make them beat you. And he tried to nibble, and he just never got anything going. Pablo Sandoval, the fat panda, comes in. He grounds out right to Hauser. And he does so in such a way that they only get one out. They get him at first, Pablo Sandoval at first. I mean, you figure with the speed that Pablo Sandoval does not possess, you'd hope to be able to turn two, but Hauser gets the one. One run scores. It's now 5-3. Steven Vogt, who we all remember from last year at the Brewers, Steven Vogt comes in, hits a sac fly. It is now 5-4. Hauser finishes out the inning, but you know that doesn't really that's the beginning of the end there for that Brewers team, giving up those runs with basically getting two outs, but giving up three more runs on four walks, a ground out and a sac fly. I mean, the ground out, if you don't have guys on base, that's great. The sac fly, if there's nobody on base, it's just a fly out. But the problem is you walk the bases loaded and then walk the guy in. Joe Panik gets a sac fly in the sixth, ties up the game. The Brewers are able to briefly retain the or get the lead back, only to give it away in the seventh. So in the seventh inning, they get up 6-5 and then go down 7-6. Vogt gets an RBI and Yelich gets a solo home run to finish out the scoring. Brewers lose 8-7 in a game. We're entering the fifth. They're up 5-1. So then the last game of the series here, Brewers finally pulled off a win in this one. It's massively infuriating that they had to have this. They went down. They were 2-2 in the second. In the second inning, it was 2-2. Samardzija takes the loss, which is always fun to see. Former Cubs Samardzija. Hader gets a 17th save. Fat Matt Albers going 3-2 now as he gets the win as the Brewers take the lead in the fourth and hold on to win that. We did not, again, get much from our starter. Chase Anderson pitches four innings, gives up three earned runs, four walks, three strikeouts. That's not where you want to be. Albers comes in the fifth. He came in the fifth. Four from Anderson. Fifth inning belongs to Albers. Brewers at that point go up 4-2. Becomes 4-3. And then eventually a 5-3 win for the Brewers. So because Anderson didn't actually get to five innings, the win for Albers coming in the fifth, he gets the win. He came in with a lead, a 3-2 lead, and just held on to it. He gets the win in this game. Junior Guerra gets a hold. Jeffers gets a hold. Hader gets a hold. The talk all year and the anger around the Brewers has been, well, first off, Aguilar not hitting, Shaw not hitting. As you saw this week, we've got Aguilar getting a couple hits, scoring, you know, getting back up to batting 200. Shaw gets a home run. I believe he's got five now, even with the injuries and such. So some of that's starting to come slowly around on that end. Grandal has been hitting lights out this year. He's been fantastic. That's been an incredible pickup. That's really, really helped this team to stay above water. I don't know that they're in this race at this point without Grandal. Yelich continues to be just a beast. He's just killing it all over the park and doing just great things out there. The starting pitching gets us through a little bit, but it has not been finishing games, and that's what's killing me. They don't get to the sixth inning. And, you know, like we just talked about, Peralta gets you four and then falls apart in the fifth. Anderson only got you four, and then you got to rely on Albers and Guerra and all of them to get you down the stretch for that win. We had Nelson, got four very good innings, and then just lost it in the fifth. And maybe he's just, you know, he's getting there. He pitched very well for four innings, which was a little bit better than last time. And you just need to be able to get him further, a little deeper in games, because you want to get six. I mean, you want to get five, but you want to get six. You want to get some of those quality starts, because nobody's pitching complete games almost anywhere, especially not in Milwaukee. But you started to get some of these games where you need to get more of these at least quality starts out of these guys and getting six-inning games, because we're getting four-inning games out of our pitchers now, and then putting them in the fifth is what kills us. I mean, this is the point where we're going to start talking about, hey, do you think Council's going to start pitching guys in the fifth? It isn't the bullpen that's killing them right now. The bullpen kind of has been holding the status quo after getting kind of beat up in the first several innings. But the bullpen at this point in the year, this week, I mean, and it's a week-to-week league at this point, the last 2 weeks, it hasn't been the bullpen that's been killing the Brewers. It has been the fact that they have just not been able to get enough out of their starters to get them deep enough into this. Look, Junior Guerra has looked okay. I mean, he's been fine, and he can get you two or three innings if you really need him to. Hader and Jeffress look good. They look good. They look great. They're doing exactly what you expect from them at this point. We didn't worry about that. Matt Albers has looked all right. He's a guy who's a solid, decent middle reliever. He's a guy who can come and get you a hold, and he's pitched pretty well. Claudio had a couple ups and downs this week, but he's looked pretty good this year. I said it last week. I still think that he's a good pickup. I know some people on Twitter have disagreed with me on this, but I still think he's been fine. The big part is we need to have our closers get to the sixth so we can start saying, Matt Albers, you'll pitch once a week, once every 2 days, every 3 days, something like that. We can get a little bit less time with Claudio going out there, maybe not every day. We can spend that time trying to just work with our bullpen a little bit better here. But the problem is Nelson's giving us four, Peralta's giving us four. Davies normally does much better than this, but Davies gave us five okay and good innings, not great. He couldn't get a six this week. We'll see a little bit more. We've got Chacin actually starting tonight at Monday night, and I'm recording a little earlier than normal. But Chacin coming back, trying to get against the Padres. Padres are a losing team right now, and the Brewers need to win this. And you almost say they need to get a sweep here. Brewers right now, third best record in the National League. They're a game up on the Cubs, 3.5 up on St. Louis. That's heading into the Monday night game. Haven't played it yet. 8 up on Pittsburgh, 8 up on Cincinnati. Game and a half back at this point of Atlanta, it looks like. They're 42-30. We're 40-31. So 9 games over 500. Dodgers walking away. We'll see what happens there. But the Brewers need to start winning these games, the games where you're supposed to win. The games, you get that split with Atlanta. That's nice, but, it's something you maybe didn't expect. But then you can't go lose a series in San Francisco. And with all that, and with the fact that I'm not happy with some of the things they've been doing and how people are underperforming at this point, again, like I just said, the Brewers are in first place, not tied. They are alone in first place at this point, halfway through June. So that is what it is. So that's our Brewers news. Just the big point, the big takeaway from this week is the fifth inning killed them. And it killed them with their starters for the most part. The one big win that they had was a late inning win in Houston. And then the other one they had was one where they already had the lead by the fifth and there was already a reliever in starting the fifth. So you talk about, is Council going to start looking at getting closers in, bringing guys like Guerra to pitch two or three innings? Maybe somebody like that. If we're bringing Chacin back, do you move Peralta back into the bullpen, have him pitch two or three innings, and get your starters, those couple starters, Woodruff and Davies, you count on going six. But if you start saying things like, I don't know about Chacin right now, what if we're looking at some of these other guys and saying they're not getting us through six, especially when you bring in Nelson, who's still recovering, maybe you say, just get him four. Get him four innings and count on Guerra pitching those days, or count on Peralta coming in or something like that. You got to get a look like that and see what they're going to do. I count on Council thinking outside the box to try to find a way to win, because he's just looking to get through that day. He really is. With a team like this, the Yankees, you get to think long term. You get to think big picture. With the Packers, the Brewers, with the Brewers, you're thinking that day. So that's where we are at this day. Moving on into our little bit of Packers news. There were a couple little personnel things. I know we're all massively excited by bringing up personnel moves, right? And by personnel, I don't mean actual players. I'm talking about people in the personnel department. This week, Richmond Williams was promoted to director of pro personnel. I believe he's a former Iowa player, cornerback, and special teamer. He is now entering his 12th season with the Packers. He was a college scout from 2012 through 2016 and a pro scout for the last two seasons. He's moving up to the director of pro personnel. So basically, he formerly scouted college players, then he starts scouting the pro players, meaning he's looking at players on other teams. He's watching the film to start get the idea of, what do we want to do if we're looking off season, are we looking at waiver moves? Are we looking at adding people in free agency? Are we looking at, you know, possible trade situations, things like that? He was the guy, one of the guys at least, that they've relied on the last couple of years to start looking at those players who are already pros and get the information so that they have a better idea of how to talk about these players and what is their valuable contributions that they've made, who could they be for the Packers, what are they worth, sorts of things. So he's moving on up, going to be the director of pro personnel. One of the other announced changes this week is that Brett Thiessen is now going to be a college scout. He was actually a scouting intern last year. So he's moving up into the lower rung, the college scouting, then to pro scouting, then on up like there. He's moving from scouting intern up to college scout. I know some people have talked to at Acme Packing. Owen Reese was very good. If you follow him at Acme Packing or at Bucky's Fifth Quarter, he does a lot of great stuff with college football and also college draft into the pro stuff. So he does some very good things there. And Owen Reese was talking about that he's met Thiessen. It seems like he's a very good guy. So good luck to him and good luck to Richmond. And we hope to see, you know, good things from this department as they continue moving along. Now, this goes into a little bit of what happened next. We did have a cut this week. Now, nobody replaced this player, but Capri Bibbs. And when I hear Capri Bibbs, I think of knee-length overalls, I guess. But Capri Bibbs, of course, we remember the Packers picked him up last year, mid-season, as a waiver addition last year, formerly with Washington, and then I guess previously with Denver, though I don't really remember him as much with Denver. He did have some run with Washington over the last couple of, well, over last season, or the year before. But, yeah, Packers picked him up late. He caught, I believe, three passes, and I know he only ran the ball one time and got 2 yards. So he was released this week. It was a little surprising. Friend of the podcast, Andy Herman, who you can follow at Scani Sports on Twitter, he was just talking just this week about how much he liked Bibbs and how much he thought he was doing a good job in the training camp so far. Of the list of people, if you follow him, he had a list of people who he thought who were making really big strides, looked great in camp this far. Capri Bibbs was one of the first ones that I was kind of surprised by, I guess, because I didn't expect much from Bibbs coming back as a late waiver pickup last year. But he was on the list, and the only guy, you know, Herman didn't like was, I said, Josh Jones has not been really making his case at this point, and that's sadly one of the most predictable things. But we're talking about here is Capri Bibbs. Not being there is going to be an interesting thing. He apparently was showing a lot of athleticism and a lot of ability. You got to believe that being a pass catcher is going to be a big part of this offense. Though I guess you don't know for sure. I guess that who they were looking at last year, and I guess the last two running backs that LaFleur has had as an offensive coordinator have been Todd Gurley, followed by Derrick Henry. He's had bigger backs there. And Derrick Henry, I don't think he's a terrible pass catcher, but he's not known for that. He's not a particularly great pass catcher. He's a downhill runner. He's a big guy. He's got good strength. Decent lateral movement, but he's known for being a downhill guy. Maybe that has something to do with it. I mean, we already have a guy who can really get to the edge, can get that pass catching, and has just kind of those freak athletic qualities, and Aaron Jones. Maybe we'll see something different. In part, I mean, LaFleur's offense last year in Tennessee is in part of who he had on the field and who he had available to him. I mean, he had Derrick Henry, and that's the kind of style of running he had. Maybe it's going to be different with the sort of guys he has. You know, they brought in a couple guys here, but they have had, Williams, and they've had Aaron Jones. And so maybe they're looking more at that style. I mean, Jones is a shorter guy, but he's still pretty thick, and he's got great balance. He can run between the tackles if you need to. Maybe that's just the Bibbs wasn't matching what they were looking for here. Another friend of the podcast, Jim Widener, was talking about this on Twitter as well, and he was wondering if it was an RAS thing, of course, pointing out to the fact that back to that scouting department we were just talking about, the Packers have become one of the groups moving more towards that analytical look at players, the using the sports analytics to try to measure players and try to find unique qualities without just saying like, oh, they've got it, you know. So he's wondering if RAS was something I got in here. I don't think that that's it, because Kabri Bibbs, I have to imagine, does very well in RAS. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. I didn't even actually look at it, I guess. I know he mentioned that, but I don't think that this is one of those sorts of things, because he seems like he's a massively athletic sort of player, a good pass catcher, good on the edges, got good speed and agility. It just maybe just didn't work. So that being said, the Packers, like I said, they've cut him, but at this point have not yet added another player. So they're only at 89 on the roster, and they have not bounced back up to 90. Of course, by the time you listen to this, maybe they've fixed that. The other fun piece of news, which is not news, but it's just we're so bored with the fact of where we are at this point that we are insistent on having some sort of sports news. And so every quote, every anything is going to be something that we have to talk about. So Aaron Rodgers said, and here's the quote, "I don't think you want to ask me to turn off 11 years," end of quote there, and at least break that up. He's talking about making the calls at the line of scrimmage, audibly out of things, giving the check with me, things like that. So here's the next part, though, is, quote, "We have a number of check with me's and line of scrimmage stuff. It's just the other stuff that really not many people in this league can do," end of quote. Now, he later then says things like, well, it's not like a humble brag. And I'll say, no, that's not a humble brag at all. It's not even like a humble brag. That's a straight up brag. When you say the thing that not many people can do, you're not humbly bragging. You're just telling everybody you're better than other people. Now he backs it up. That's fine. I don't mind that. I'm not upset with Rodgers for saying any of this thing. But of course, the bit is, how much freedom is he being given at that line of scrimmage at this point? And how much does it bother him? First off, if he's talking about it, then it's something he's thinking about. And it's something he's saying, you don't want me to turn that off. You know, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. That's what he's telling you. But I don't think it's time to go to the code red here, my friend. Aaron, you worry about hearing things like, I don't think you want me to stop doing the things I've been doing. It's been so great. Except for, of course, this team didn't make the playoffs the last 2 years. We're not saying Aaron Rodgers' experience or his ability to read a defense is bad. It's obviously great. It's incredible. But there have been problems with this team in terms of how they've been handling those situations over the last couple of years. The fact that Aaron seems to have sometimes called the audible out of something that looked like it was going to work. We've seen some things. If you look at Ben Fennell or Andy Herman or any of these other places where they've been putting up the video of it over the last couple of years, over the last year at least, we'll say. Some of the other people, I forget some of the other names now, but there have been several other places where they've been putting up a lot of the videos of, like, just watch, where there's clear run-pass options. He's going to pick pass. Even when the numbers, when you go to the line of scrimmage, tell you, this is a run play. You should be running. So with all that 11 years, with all that experience, you don't want to turn it off, but how much has it been working over the last year? When he has been given the opportunity to take a run pass option, he's going to pick pass either way. It doesn't matter if the numbers tell him he shouldn't. So, yeah, Aaron, run the offense. You want to take a great look, and this is what Aaron would say, because Aaron is, of course, our resident Patriots apologist. But in this case, he would be exactly right, because the Patriots are exactly what you should be trying to be. At this point in the history of the NFL, you should be trying to do that. You should be trying to match that. Tom Brady, for all of his ego and everything, he understands exactly where his bread is buttered. He knows that he needs to play the system. He doesn't try to overcome the system. He doesn't try to beat the system. He's great at the line of scrimmage as well. I'll tell you that. He's fantastic at reading that at the line of scrimmage. But he plays within himself, and he plays in the system that his coach wants him to play. They don't turn the ball over. They don't throw deep that much. He throws shallow. He has the lowest average depth of target in the NFL. I mean, he just does. He's throwing 5 yards downfield and letting his players make plays. He knows that the best things happen when the ball is out of his hand. Nothing good happens while the ball is still in Tom Brady's hands because he's not going to run away from anybody on that field. He needs to get the ball out of his hands. Aaron, you need to start thinking about that. You need to get the ball out of your hands. We score touchdowns far more when you're not running. We score touchdowns when Devontae is running, when Aaron Jones is running with the ball, when Geronimo Allison is running with the ball, when MVS is running with the ball, when EQ is running with the ball. We need those people to have their hands on the ball. Get it out of your hands. Run the system. Because the system's going to get people into positions where they can do something with the ball once they have it. The problem is when you start thinking so much about what you're going to do with the ball and scoring with your throw, you're forgetting that get the ball down the field and let it go. Tom Brady sacrifices his ego to the system. And it, you know, and the problem is that system pays him back. It pays him back in full because his numbers are still good. I mean, he's not suffering from any of the problems from throwing short. His completion percentage is crazy. His completion percentage is great. And he's throwing to open guys because they don't have to be open for long. He's getting the ball out of his hand. He's throwing it as short passes. He's throwing it to people right away. He's playing within the system. He's not insistent on getting the ball down the field or showing you anything big with his arm. Tom Brady doesn't throw great big long throws almost ever. But he's able to take guys who are good receivers, good slot receivers, and just make them phenomenal by just getting the ball to them quickly. He's very accurate short, and he knows it. And his coach knows it. And that's their system. Their system is they're going to keep doing this. He's going to go back one, two, three, plant his foot, look, toss. Not option one, sometimes option two. Aaron, there's nothing wrong with playing in that. You can still be a great quarterback without having to go do all the stuff on your own. We don't need the hero ball in order to win the game. If you get the ball into the hands of all these fast, speedy guys that they've been putting around you, you're going to look great. And everybody's going to give you credit for winning. They give Tom Brady all the credit in the world for winning, even though he's had a top 10 scoring defense basically every year in his time in the league. His defense is maybe in yards they give up is not great. They've always been a top 10 defense in scoring. And every time that they're top five, they win Super Bowls. Or at least go to Super Bowls. Tom Brady has an incredible team around him. He gets all the credit in the world. Aaron, you'll get the same thing. You will get all the credit in the world for winning because we pretend that wins our quarterback stat. Just let the team win. Go out and do those things. I hope that this is a weird camp thing that's a real non-story, but that's the only thing I want to talk about is to say, I hope Aaron knows that, yeah, you want to do the check with me's, you want to do all the line of scrimmage stuff, you want to be known as a genius. If you win games, they're going to call you genius no matter what you do. They will. So just go out there and win games. Run the system. Let the system work. Don't try to kill it yet. You haven't even played a game in it. Go out there and play in the system. Figure it out as you go. That's all that we really have here in terms of our ongoing Packers Brewers coverage. There's, of course, no Bucks. There's no hockey. There's no Badgers at this point yet. But we'll run up a couple of last thoughts here because we don't really have anything in the summer here in the doldrums of the summer to fill in much. And I don't have Aaron to ad lib. So we'll round everything up here. Just our last call.
Time to look around and get your bearings. It's time for the last call.
Okay, so like I said, there's not really a lot else to cover in sports right now. The one big thing is Women's World Cup is on. And I'm going to give it the same sort of credence that I would give the Men's World Cup, which is to say that I'm barely watching, but I have an interest in the Team USA winning. I'll watch some of the women's team because I like supporting my country. I don't find soccer particularly enjoyable. I think it's like hockey where no one is trying to score. That being said, I would like to see them win because they're the U.S. team, and I root for the U.S. team. Now, there was some talk this week, obviously, because the women's team beat Thailand 13-0. Apparently, last time they'd played, they beat them 9-0. And there was some argument about whether or not they should have been continuing to score like that and whether or not they should have been celebrating the way they do. Now, it's a once-in-every-four-year event. However you want to celebrate, I don't care. I think that you have license to celebrate however you want when your sport plays the biggest thing that ever happens to it once every 4 years. Celebrate however you want. I don't care. Also, goal differential does matter in games like this. And you know what? who's to say that who else is in there? I think Norway or Sweden or somebody's in the group. They could beat Thailand by a lot. You may as well score when you can. There's no reason to stop. Also, soccer doesn't let you do the substitutions. You have limited substitutions in soccer, and so you can't take out your starters. You're not playing your backups because you can't. There's no such thing. And that's, of course, one of the big things that's wrong with soccer. Here's what soccer should do. They should try to be more like rugby. They should have a zone where you can go in and get more switches during the game. They could run a clock as if it's the 21st century, maybe, even if it's the official running the clock. You could quickly and easily have some sort of thing where they're starting the clock and it's also tied to a clock in the stadium. So everybody knows how much time is left because there's no reason to be secretive about it. It's the 21st century. But there should be some way of changing out people, and there should be unlimited changes. That now that we have metrics and we can analyze things, we can also judge that all soccer players are saving their energy for the last 5 minutes of each half. So it's 40 minutes of just trying to keep in a game, followed by 5 minutes of just frenzy. And that frenzy is the best part of soccer, where everybody is just pushing the ball down the field and trying to score. The problem is they only do that because you've created an incentive system where they should. You would be foolish to try to force yourself to play full speed for 45 minutes when the other side is just trying to keep you out of the goal for 40 minutes and then trying to kick it in for the last five. It's a long game and there's no substitutions. They should put in a substitution policy that allows things to change and to bring players in far more frequently. What I think would be more fun, what would make it very, very exciting, is create a zone. Just like you put a player in, once the player steps into that zone, that player can leave so you can change on the fly. You know, just set up one at midfield for something like that. And it would be hard to do sometimes maybe for defenders and forwards, but you know, you could do that during stoppages in play, try to get the ball up the field. If you could play more in the offensive zone, it would make soccer way more exciting and it would bring people to watch the game. Sure, it changes it a little bit, but only in that more people would be able to play. You'd have, it would be obviously more beneficial for teams that have more depth, but the game is just, it is what it is. Now, you can't make changes, so Team USA left in all their starters except for, you know, the two or three or whatever they get to change. And they kept scoring. So yeah, you can't fault them for that because you left in their starters. There's nothing they can do. They can't just pull out their starters like you would in a football game and start getting backups a chance to play. Your own rules don't let them do it. So that part is crazy. Also, the idea that, I guess a lot of people have been saying, like, you wouldn't say this about the men's team. Now, we'll never know. Because the men's team hasn't scored 13 goals in the last 380 some odd days. It's been over a year since they've scored a total of 13 goals. All right. So the men's team, it's just not even a comparison. The women's team is so much better than the men's team. And the crazy thing for me is that they're fighting for equal pay. The women's team should get paid more than the men's team. They're the only one you really want to watch because you know the women's team is probably going to win. That team is great. That team is elite. The men's team didn't even qualify for the World Cup last year. It shouldn't be close. The women's team should get paid more than the men's team, and I don't know what the argument against it is. It's not like they're bringing in a ton more money for the U.S. I mean, I understand nationally, globally, men's soccer and the World Cup brings in way more than the Women's World Cup. Whatever, our men's team isn't doing that. By the way, they didn't even go last time. So why are they getting paid anything more than the women's national team? The women's national team has been winning. They've been killing it. And at worst, it should be closer to even, especially on representing your nation. And I know Tony Kornheiser mentioned something like this too, because I want to give credit for any idea that I didn't first come up with. He was talking about in the pro leagues, your league doesn't bring in money. You don't get paid equal pay. But these are national teams. They're coming from the same, FIFA and all that. They should get at least equal or comparable pay. And if not, then, definitely the women's team should be the one that's paid more because they're the better team. And they're the one we're watching. They're the ones we know. They're the ones who go on the commercials because they're far more recognizable because we like winners. The other thing I'll say is that a lot of this comes up because, of course, we don't have a sports reporting industry much in the U.S. We, of course, do if you're looking for it. But what we have is a sports entertainment industry where we have people like Colin Cowherd and Skip Bayless guiding the discussion when they don't have any particular training that makes them better at watching or judging or breaking down anything. Colin Cowherd routinely shows you that he doesn't know what he's talking about when he starts making broad judgments. He kept telling you that Aaron Rodgers was a terrible quarterback who wouldn't be anything until the moment he won, then he loved him. He's a bandwagon jumper. He doesn't actually analyze the game in any way. Skip Bayless, his commenting on the NBA Finals, which, by the way, I didn't watch a minute of it, but still it ruins the entire thing, because you follow people on there who really are watching and giving you great substance and everything. Even though I'm not watching, I can get an idea of what's going on by the great substance of their talk. But Skip Bayless just spends his entire time griping about Kawhi Leonard and how much he doesn't like Kawhi Leonard because Kawhi Leonard left his team. He's just a fan who talks. He has specific animus against an individual player because he left and doesn't even hide it and won't talk about the actual game of basketball other than to say that he doesn't like this one player for leaving. I don't go that far. I mean, we run what is a sports-based, Wisconsin-based thing, and I don't go so far as to ignore an entire game simply to attack another player. This is the sort of thing you get when you start following that stuff, and it is frustrating and infuriating, but that is the state of where sports is right now. It's not going to get better unless we stop watching these turkeys. Now, speaking of people who are fun and interesting to follow and are going to be a topic of much discussion in the sports world, crossing into the real world, everybody, I think, by now has seen that O.J. Simpson now has a Twitter feed, which he is posting tons of video of himself talking about how great he is and setting the record straight. So I'm of several minds on this. It's going to be interesting to see what he does with this Twitter feed, but it's also going to be a bit of, you know, you're just signing up for the circus and you are asking to have somebody lie to your face. So take that for what it is. I'm not going to tell anybody who they should or should not follow, other than to say there are people I do tell you should follow, like Andy Herman or Jim Widener or Owen Reese or, you know, people like that. Those people should be followed because they do great work. But, I don't know what to do with O.J. Simpson. It's a thing that's out there in the zeitgeist and definitely something people are talking about and definitely a lot of people telling you just don't follow him because you're feeding into the problem. But at the same time, it's going to be like a worse version of following Jose Canseco, who, by the way, you should follow Jose Canseco because he's a massively entertaining train wreck. That being said, that's all that we have for you this week. Thank you again for joining us. Hopefully we'll have Aaron back very soon. I hope everybody had a great Father's Day. For those who had, you know, obviously your fathers in your life, if you have a relationship with those individuals, and for those of you who are fathers, great Father's Day. Looking forward to another great week in Brewers baseball and hopefully a little bit less real Packers news. So there's that. Again, you can follow the show at ScannyJohnny1. You can follow this follow me myself here as ScannyJohnny. At JBarn54. You can follow Aaron at Cheddar Talk. All of that on Twitter, of course. You can go to our webpage, ScannyJohnny.com. You can also check us out on Facebook and any other places. Remember to go and rate, review us. We say download, listen, rate, review us, and share this podcast with all your family and friends. And of course, remember that whether you are on the town or on the go, that it is always on Wisconsin.
This has been the Scanny Johnny Podcast. Remember to find the boys on Twitter at ScannyJohnny1 or online at ScannyJohnny.com. Thanks for listening.